Okay. Welcome to day 10. Are there any questions about the previous 9 days that I can address right now? Why don't we start by
two questions related to some concepts we talked about last time. Okay, so here's my example function. Look at this. I've got two different graphs of it here, so I'll pass these around so you can look at them. One graph looks at from x equals 0 to 5. One zooms in to see what's happening closer to x equals 4. Okay. So I think the first question is, what's the biggest possible domain you could define this on as a, this, if you limit your inputs and outputs to real numbers, right, this defines a partial function. If you try any real input, either it doesn't make sense or you get a real output. Okay, what are the real inputs for which this function would make sense? In other words, what is the domain of f implied by that definition? Usually easier to think about where things go wrong, right? What could go wrong? Division by zero. What else could go wrong? Square root of a negative. So, two things that could go wrong, and everywhere else, the function is well-defined. So the domain is the set of all reals where x is not negative, and x is not 4. If you want to write that in interval notation, it would look like this. Questions in terms of some stuff we defined last time. Is f increasing? Remember what it means to be increasing. So in other words, is have any two things, one less than or equal to the other, and you plug them into f, is their output also the same way? Now, obviously, it doesn't make sense to demand this for x and y not in the domain. So, but do you have this for everything that is in the domain? Well, look at the graph. No. If you want to do some algebra, you can come up with an explicit example. Right? You only need one counterexample. Okay. So how can I cook up a counterexample? Well, I know that the sine of pi over 2 is 1, and I know that the sine of pi is 0. So if I could rig, if I could rig it so that I had this be pi over 2, and then it would come out positive. But then if I picked x larger to somehow rig it to be pi, right, then it would be 0. Can I do that? Let's see. Not quite. Not the way you might guess. You need to be careful about this. How about zero and pi, but then. Where the function is decreased. Okay. I know what I'll do. I will start. Yeah, let's see if this works. So, let's see. Pi over 2. Yeah, it's kind of tricky here. This function in here is decreasing. The sort of reciprocal function is decreasing, at least, except where the sign change happens. Then this, depending on what the values are, can either be increasing or decreasing. So I think if I look at this where it's decreasing, then this where it's increasing. This thing was is this? This is going to be the sine of 3 halves pi, which is negative 1. Okay? So this one is 0, this one is negative. So it's a lot easier to see it on the graph than to actually come up with specific inputs that witness it. You could ask the same question, is f decreasing? Does it always flip the order? Well, no, it oscillates. You can see it on the graph. I think if you let now, this was kind of building on an interval from like you want to have the values that sine gets. I had them go from 3 halves pi to 2 pi to make them run with the reciprocals that I'm decreasing and increasing. Here, I think I would just go from pi over half to pi. Cook up my example. So this is asking him, does it always reverse the order of inputs? No, it doesn't. Stuff happens, but I rigged the input to the sine to be pi, and 0, and this is not greater than or equal to this thing, because this thing will be some positive number, and when you take the square root times sine of 2, which is positive 1. Okay, so this is positive. You can find ways to make the oscillations you saw in the handout explicit algebraically if you really want to. I'm not sure how fun it is. Okay. And next question then.
We could ask, is f
bounded above? What does that mean? That means, is the range of f bounded above? So in other words, or id est in Latin, which means is there an upper bound for all the outputs of f? So how do we unpack that? Is there a real, call it u, upper, such that, so what are the outputs of f? Well, in terms of our formula, for any x in the domain, the corresponding output is f of x. So the set of all outputs is the set of all things f of x, where x came from the domain. So can you find a number greater than or equal to every number of the form f of x, where f of x is actually defined? Or given any real number u, is there a counterexample? you remember that graph I passed out, the oscillations, they get pretty wild near 4, but away from 4, they tend to die down. This one's a little trickier. But here's how I would think about it. As X gets large, this thing is going to, the X minus 4 will also get large, the reciprocal will approach 0. The sine of a small angle is also a small angle, right? Sine of 0, 0. In the limit, when x is large, this is going to be something small. And on the other hand, the square root is going to be something big. So the question is, which gets smaller faster? Take some more advanced stuff to do that. Or at least to prove it.
You might remember the tools you need from Calculus 2 to prove it.
But I'll tell you essentially what's going on. Goes to infinity, this thing shrinks about as fast as 1 over x. So that means it's shrinking faster than the square root of x gets big. Which means that in the limit towards big x, it's 0. And so you can bound it. So when x is large, the function is small. It's small in size, you know, whether it's positive or negative. For say, some big number here, how about 1,000? And then you can check that, you know, on the finite interval, that there is some upper bound. For everything less than 1,000. Which would just be what? Well, in the domain, you have this. Where I've given you the tools to prove this, but
that's essentially what's going on.
You can see the graph, and you'll see that, you know, at least from 4 to 5, it's bounded. It gets bigger. But not very much beyond that. You know, but because this thing here will make it shrink faster than the square root factor would make it grow.
So it's not like the oscillations just grow in size forever.
But it actually stops oscillating because the input angles, because of this thing here, are actually confined. Take the reciprocal. same reasons, you know, it's bounded below. If you want the oscillations to grow without control, you might do something like this. If you didn't have that reciprocal thing going on, then something like this will break all the bounds, right? If you're given U a real, let X be, let's see, we want to trick it somehow, so how about 2 pi want to basically get take U, round it up to the nearest integer, say, and multiply it by 2 pi, and then add a half pi. Well, we got a square root there, so go ahead and square U. Okay. That'll fool it. Right? That'll get you above you. By rounding u squared up to an integer, then this multiple of 2 pi doesn't have any effect on the input. Right? It'll be the same as if I just input pi over 2 to sine. On the other hand, this thing here will be, the x is bigger than u squared, so this is just 1, so. And this will be the absolute value of u, which is certainly at least u. So. If u is negative, then they'd be different. If u is positive, it's the same as its absolute value. So this would be where the oscillations wouldn't die down.
Reciprocal makes them die.
Okay, so that's kind of what you call global stuff. If you consider all possible inputs, what happens? What can happen? What does happen? Right? If we consider all possible inputs, we see things like you can have inputs where the order is flipped. You can have inputs where the order is strictly kept the same. But on a local level, you could have, there are little pieces of the graph where it is increasing, and little pieces where it is decreasing. And we can also talk about limits. And a limit is a local thing. Okay? And the way we talk about local things, formally, is we have to have some kind of concept of what's local, what's close, and what's far away. So that leads us to a neighborhood. A neighborhood of a real A is a non-empty open interval with center A. Okay? I'll draw it vertically. Right? So here's another way to think about it. The set of all N, where N is a neighborhood of A, is the set of all intervals of the form A minus delta to A plus delta, excluding endpoints, where delta is positive. Right. So that would be this distance.
right? This is often called the radius of the interval.
Now, sometimes people use a more general concept of neighborhood, where they say a neighborhood is any superset of a set like that. Okay.
So I just warn you that if you're reading, you know, a math book, you may see a more general usage. So they would say that the set of all neighborhoods of A is the set of all sets, S subset of the real line where there exists a delta such that one of my kinds of neighborhoods is a subset. Right? So it would be like one of these intervals plus possibly some extra stuff. And that there are other people that demand the extra stuff be made up of, have additional properties. But this is the definition I'll use because it keeps things simple for us. But basically, definitions are not right or wrong. They're useful or not useful. So if you want to talk about limits and local behaviors, you focus on what's happening in a neighborhood. Okay? So given a function, let's say it's a partial function, like ours over there. From the reals to the reals, and a real A, let's be more general. Let's just say we have S is a set of reals, okay? Then what you want to think about is making a restriction of F to just some set. Okay, so you want to throw away inputs that are sort of far away from what you don't want. In the case where S is a neighborhood, you just want to throw away the stuff that's too far away from A. So there's this notation. This switch from G to F. The restriction of G to S, which is what? Well, in terms of the ordered pair definition of functions, you know, as a binary relation, it'd be the set of all x, comma, g of x, where x is in the domain of g, of course, but now, if it's not an S, we throw it out.
What does that look like? If, say, this is my set S, and I have some function here, you know, g, then to restrict it to S, I would just have to throw away any part of the graph where the input, that is the x-coordinate, is not in S. So in this case, I would get this part of the graph. So now it's a function that if G had a formula, this G restricted S would have the same formula, but we would only allow inputs to there. If you know LaTeX, the way to make this symbol in LaTeX is backslash up harpoon right. I guess it looks kind of like the right half of the harpoon pointing up.
Okay. So now you can say stuff. For example, okay? If you want to talk about being locally increasing or decreasing, right? You say that what would this mean? It would mean for everything in the domain of G, there is a neighborhood, so some little interval around that point, such that if you restrict to that neighborhood, then the function becomes increasing. So for example, if this graph here, right, if I had, say, an interval right here, I'll call it T, right, then the corresponding part of the graph would be right here. See, around there, G of T is decreasing. So sometimes I'm making a restriction. Get more control. And you could also have something even more localized, like G is locally increasing at a particular point. That would just mean that there is a neighborhood N of B such that when you restrict to that neighborhood, your function is increasing. Okay, so. So if you look at the graph that I passed around, you'll see that there, with our crazy function f here, there's lots of points where it's locally increasing or locally decreasing. If you just restricted it to some little small open interval around a point, the inputs would be the inputs would result in a function that is either always order preserving or always order reversing. Always increasing, always decreased. Okay. However, there would be some points where it's not even locally increasing there. Like if you looked at one of the tops of an oscillation,
at the crest of a wave, or at the trough of a wave, at the bottom of an oscillation, there it would not be locally increasing, right? So now I want to add more to my thing here, right? It's like right here, it's locally increasing. Right here, it's locally decreasing. But here, it's not at the bottom, likewise at the top of one of these oscillations, it's not locally increasing or decreasing. It's always, no matter how small a little open interval you shrink it to around here, it's always got some of both. It'll always have an increasing part and a decreasing part. It'll always have an increasing part on the right and a decreasing part on the left. Now, when you're doing limits for a sequence,
with limits for a sequence, we talked a lot about the tail ranges. You'd throw away finely made points at the beginning of the sequence. You'd have the tail of all the leftover stuff. And then you looked at all outputs from that tail. That was the tail range. And so we were talking about limit, lim sup, and just plain limits. We were always talking about what happens to that tail, right? What are the least upper bounds for all the different tails you can get? What are the greatest lower bounds? Can you get the tail to commit to really small intervals around some limiting value? Okay. We can take all of those ideas and we can apply them to functions, except instead of talking about tails, we talk about restricting the function to a neighborhood and then seeing what the range is. Okay. The catch is that sometimes you have to modify the neighborhood a little bit. Like if you're doing a right-hand limit, you have to restrict the function to just the right half of the neighborhood. And generally, you always want to not include the center point itself when you're taking a limit. That's the
annoyance,
is that you want to have a simple analogy of tails correspond to restrictions to neighborhoods, but you have to modify the neighborhood a little bit.
Okay, so.
In general, right, our functions may be partial. And they may not be defined everywhere, just like our crazy f isn't. Okay. So a tail corresponds to f restricted to a neighborhood. Might have to modify it a little bit to do the limit properly. I guess if you start using f's, I'll put f there, then I'll have to have a sequence here, right? So a tail would be something that would form, say, you start at term k, right? But you throw away all the stuff that came before n equals k. Right? And then you have the tail ranges. Look at all the outputs of that tail. And analogously here, you would consider just the output set for your restricted function, which in terms of the notation I introduced last time, you could write it like this. So this would be the set of all f of x, where x is in the domain of f, and in our possibly modified neighborhood. We'll talk about the modification in a bit. Crazy function f there. Right? What happened? How can we describe what's going on near 4? We could summarize it by saying there's all sorts of crazy stuff that happens, but when you're near 4, those crazy oscillations are roughly between negative 2 and 2. Say is the lim soup, to be clear, meaning as x approaches 2 of f of x, not f, as x approaches 4, 2, that's the upper limit. The lower limit is negative 2. One of the that. Remember how that graph looked. So imagine kind of a think of the square root function as kind of an envelope for how big, think of it as like the possible amplitude factor for these oscillations. Okay, so it can either be, the sign will always be between negative 1 and 1 in output. Okay, so when you multiply by square root of x, what you get in the product output is always between positive and negative square root of x. So let's say we're at 4 here. Okay, so that corresponds to 2. And negative 2. And then what happens is when x is close to 4, right, this reciprocal becomes a very big number. Right? As x gets closer to 4, the reciprocal will go towards positive infinity from 1 as you approach from one way, and negative infinity as you approach from another way. So the sine function will see inputs that go through its multiples of 2 pi rapidly, right? So you'll get this very high frequency stuff happening there. Okay. But you do have the control of the amplitude factor. Okay. Now, so what do we mean by these upper and lower limits? Well, just take the analogy here. So what you actually work with, how do we modify the neighborhood in this example? You work with what's called a deleted neighborhood. Center removed. Okay. Take up the center. Okay, so
So if you remember how the limb soup worked, the upper limit, it was the infimum, the greatest lower bound, of the suprema of all the tail ranges. That's how it works in sequences. With this, we're going to take the infimum of the suprema of all the images of deleted neighborhoods of 4. Let's think about a little deleted neighborhood right here, okay? We have the sum delta, 4 minus delta to 4. We leave 4 out. We have 4 plus delta. And we look at all the inputs in this little interval around 4, but excluding 4 itself. And then this thing says, okay, give me all the outputs that come from that set. Okay? So we've got our n. What kind of outputs do we get? Well, the outputs, you're going to have a bunch of oscillations up and down, up and down. You're actually going to get everything from here to here, okay? Wherever the highest point is, the lowest point is, you're going to get that and everything in between. Supremum would be the least upper bound of that. Infimum would be that. Okay? So what is this going to be? It's going to be something a little bit bigger than 2. And this will be something a little bit less than negative 2. Here's the symmetrical definition for the lower limit. So, if you take all possible deleted neighborhoods, you'll get a bunch of intervals like this. But you look at, say, all their upper bounds here, right? All the upper bounds will be something a little bit bigger than 2. Possibly a lot bigger if you make the neighborhood really big, but they're all going to be at least 2. In fact, they're all greater than 2. But you can get them as close as you want to 2. By making the input neighborhood smaller, by making the delta smaller. Arbitrarily close to 2. Likewise, these are all less than negative 2, but by making the neighborhood really small, you can get it really close to negative 2. So 2 is the greatest lower bound of all these kind of numbers. Negative 2 is the least upper bound of all these kinds of numbers. That's the idea. And as usual, as we do with sequences, if I write something like this, that just means that the limb soup and the limb imp both exist and equal C. Right? Now,
there are many equivalent definitions of limit, right? Besides the lim sup one and the lim imp one.
I bring up lim sup and lim imp because they can describe situations where there's this kind of unending high frequency oscillation, right?
The general thing would be if G is locally bounded, right, so there's some neighborhood in which it's bounded at some real C, then the lim sup and the lim inf will exist for that one. But as this example shows, an actual limit might not exist. Right? There might be oscillations that, although they're bounded, they never decay towards zero as you approach C. So they both exist, but they might. They might be different numbers.
Questions or answers?
So all this stuff we said about sequences, you know, we talked about stuff like, does a sequence eventually do this or that? Now, when you're thinking about functions, don't think that way. Instead, think of, does the function do this or that when I restrict it to some neighborhood? All right. Let me tell you how you would modify the neighborhood if you wanted to do one-sided limits. So how would you define these kinds of things? Well, instead of using deleted neighborhoods, you just use a right neighborhood, not including the center. Otherwise, the definition is exactly the same. And again, to say that a right-hand limit exists is to say that the right-hand upper limit and right-hand lower limit exist and that they agree. And then you can imagine what you would do for a left-hand limit. Left half of neighborhoods.
I've got a typo over here, don't I? They should both exist in equal L, right? Okay. There's the point you're approaching in terms of inputs, and then there's the point you're approaching in terms of outputs. Okay, so for a limit as x approaches c to equal L means the upper and lower limits as x approaches c.
equal L.
Now,
let me give you another connection to sequences, and it'll also give you another connection to, like, say, epsilons. Okay, so here we go. Several different equivalent ways to think about this kind of limit. So we have our concept here, we tried to find in terms of limnth and limsup. Another way to think about it would just be you want the limnth and the limsup to be the same thing. So you could say it in terms of for every epsilon, right, positive, there exists a delta positive such that what? Well, you need to map your whole deleted neighborhood into the interval L plus epsilon, L minus epsilon. If you do that, you've got your lim sup under L plus epsilon, you've got your lim inf over L minus epsilon. And then as you make epsilon as small as you want, the lim sup and lim inf come together. So it'll look like this.
I've got more typos over here, don't I? A and C. Interchangeably.
Back to what I'm doing. Okay, so. So you look at all, any. So this says for any epsilon, you can find a deleted neighborhood of C of radius delta such that the output from this deleted neighborhood will fit inside of this. So. This one, you know, maybe you want a picture. Here's C minus delta. C plus delta. So the function, which may or not be defined at every point here, means whatever it does, that you need to be able to choose a delta such that all of the output lives inside some interval like this. But even if it does some weird, discontinuous stuff, as long as things seem to come together, so to speak, in the limit here, I guess we're going to maybe. Truthful pictures. In the limit, things are going to come together to out there. But you need to have this kind of truth happening on an approximate scale. So for any epsilon, you need to be able to produce a delta that does this. There's one little caveat to this, which is that if you picked a C where in the deleted neighborhood F wasn't defined at all, then this would lead you astray. It wouldn't really make sense. If f wasn't defined at all on this set, then you would get something really weird. The limit and the lim sup wouldn't exist as finite numbers. You would end up, the conventions would say like lim sup of negative infinity and lim imp of positive infinity. So what you really want is that not only is it the case that the outputs are controlled, but there has to at least be some output. Okay. So you need one other condition here, which is that for every delta positive, there has to act this has to actually produce something. Normally, no one thinks about taking a limit as x approaches c when f of x is not even defined anywhere near c. Right? But I do need to put this clause in to avoid nonsense like somebody writing the limit as x approaches negative 1 of the square root of x is 5. Okay. I mean, technically, if I pick a small enough deleted neighborhood around negative 1, the square root function isn't defined at all. So there are no outputs. So all the outputs definitely fit in the interval from 5 minus epsilon to 5 plus epsilon, no matter what that epsilon was, because there are no outputs. So there need to be some outputs from your deleted neighborhood. But normally, no one's even thinking about doing that. So this is kind of thing you put in a legal document, legalese, to avoid something no sane person would want to try. Okay. But if I don't put that in there, then technically that would be true. It would also be true that the limit as x approaches negative 1 of the square root of x is 7. Okay. But yeah, normally you won't have to worry about that because no one's going to ask you to consider these kind of crazy things. So here would be, here's the definition now in terms of sequences. You may find this interesting. You can equivalently define this as for every sequence with limit C, and corresponding to how we had to delete a point from the neighborhood, the sequence has limit C, but none of the terms in the sequence are actually C. Okay. So a sequence that's never C, but is C in the limit. Right? Like 1 over n approaches 0, but it's never equal to 0. So you imagine any sequence of inputs that is never C, but it approaches C in the limit. Then we have that the limit of the sequence of outputs is equal to L. And to avoid that kind of annoying thing, there actually exists at least one sequence that has these properties, that it converges to C, but is never equal to C. Okay. Like here, let's see. What do I need here? I know what I need. Okay, so when I wrote f of a n, that implies that the a n's are in the domain of f. So if you want to make that explicit here, you would write something like C not equal a n, but a n is in the domain of f. Okay. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to talk about f of a n. And likewise here, you do want to throw that in. So. Otherwise, yeah. But getting all that technicality out of the way, this is the usual epsilon delta definition you've seen in your calculus book. It's chapter 2 in the Stewart calculus book we use here. Right? It's equivalent to this thing I told you about in terms of lim if and lim sup. And that part's not too hard to prove. This proving that this and this, and whether you're doing it in terms, proving that 3 is equivalent to 1 or equivalent to 2, and they're actually all equivalent, proving that, you know, it takes a little bit more imagination. But it's doable. Let me say a little bit about how we connect them.
So for example, how do we make a connection between, you know, this kind of epsilonic stuff, you know, approximating the output by approximating the input? How do we connect that with the lim sup and lim imp thing? I think I'm just gonna, since I erased it on the blackboard there, I'm just gonna put it explicitly what I mean by this. So what's the connection here between that? If you remember for sequences, here's the connection you make. The lim sup of a sequence, if you say that it's less than or equal to some number b, that's equivalent to saying that for every positive epsilon, the sequence is eventually less than or equal to b plus epsilon. In other words, there exists a finite wait time such that after that finite wait time, everything is below b plus epsilon. And then imp. Say that the lim imp is greater than or equal to some number a that I already say. That should be. Okay. If and only if, for every epsilon, there's a finite wait time. That wait time, of course, depends on epsilon. Then we get that is the sequence is above b minus e. Picture for this one is it's eventually going to be in here. Whereas the picture for this one is that it's eventually in here. And if they're both true at the same time, that would mean that you'd have, if they're both, if both of these are true, that's equivalent to this. Right? So to have them both true is just to have, for every positive epsilon, there's a finite wait time such that in this little interval around B, right? So now you have both. So eventually, everything will be stuck in there. And you might have to throw away the first million terms of the sequence, but after that, everything is stuck in there. Okay? So eventually, when you take the analogy from sequences to functions, eventually means when restricted to a neighborhood, okay? So you just imagine everywhere you see, you know, so like here, in this soup, x approaches c of g of x being less than or equal to b, right? You make that change, right? And what are you going to have here? Well, instead of there exists a wait time, right, you're going to have there exists a delta, right, defining a deleted neighborhood. Okay? And so you'll have, or you can say something like, and so the image of that neighborhood will have to live in here. Okay? So you'll have for all x that are in C minus delta C, or in variable C, C plus delta, and in the domain F, you're going to have that this is, you're going to have that for any x that's, for which F is defined, or G, I guess is what I wrote there, which G is defined, and it's in this deleted neighborhood of C, you would have g of x instead of sequence term n less than b plus epsilon. So that's the analogy. Instead of a finite wait time, now you have restriction to neighborhood. So you have a totally analogous thing down here. The only caveat is to avoid something like lim sup is minus infinity, limit is positive infinity. I have to throw in a non-empty part there. See here, with the sequence, you know, the way I've written it, the domain is always the natural number, right? You input any natural number, you get out a real number here. Whereas with these partial functions, you know, sometimes, you know, there's division by zero squared, negative number, it's not defined. Okay, so let's see.
Here's what I'd like.
Something like this. See if you can define a function and graph, and even if you can only just draw its graph, that really separates, say, these four concepts. Thank you.
like separate graphs or is it one graph?
One function. Yeah. So you could zoom in and show multiple graphs, but they all need to be graphs of, you know, parts of the same function. I'll be in my office today until about 6:30. And last week's homework is due next time on Wednesday. This homework will be due the Wednesday of next week.